It always gives me great pleasure to introduce our guest speakers here at the Villa, and even greater pleasure when the speaker is a member of our curatorial department and someone I have known since we were graduate students together at UCLA. Mary Louise Hart is Associate Curator of Antiquities here at the J. Paul Getty Museum and is the curator for our current special exhibition, The Art of Ancient Greek Theater. She is also the editor and co-author of the exhibition's accompanying publication of the same name, and consulted with the museum staff who have organized all of the ancillary programs surrounding this groundbreaking exhibition. Before joining the staff of the Getty Museum in 1997, Dr. Hart taught art history at the University of Texas at Arlington and at the University of Missouri at St. Louis. She is a specialist in vase painting and the art of iconography of ancient Greek myth, epic, and drama, as well as contemporary performance and reception. She has both published and lectured widely on that topic and frequently teaches at Epidaurus, Greece, as a member of the faculty of the Forum of Ancient Drama, an intensive course on the study and practice of ancient Greek drama sponsored by the European Network of Research and Documentation of Performances of Ancient Greek Drama. Her lecture today is entitled Art and Performance in Classical Greece. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Mary Louise Hart.
Hi, I'm very excited to welcome all of you here today. This lecture is in a way a culmination of many, many years of preparation for the exhibition, and then a few months now of having the exhibition open and being able to work with it a little bit. So without too much further ado, it's always good to start with the Acropolis. So that theater that you see carved out of the south slope of the Acropolis is the Theater of Dionysus in the sanctuary of Dionysus Eleutherius in Athens. Here, the plays of Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, Aristophanes, Menander, and so many more less known playwrights were first performed. Renovation of the earlier theater was an element of Pericles' massive Acropolis project when wooden seats were placed in the hollowed out hillside, an orchestra was set for the dancing of the chorus, and perhaps a scaena or stage building was erected to frame the performances of the actors. What we experience in the theater today are the remains of the 4th century BC renovation in marble. The exhibition upstairs includes a model of this theater. In this theatron, the seeing place in Greek, as they watched the play, citizens were joined in a visual, civic, and cult experience together with statesmen, neighbors, and friends. Foreign residents and probably women also attended, as we know partly from the famous later adage of pregnant women miscarrying at the sight of Aeschylus's frightful furies. Many of the men in the audience would have been performers themselves, for the choruses of the plays were composed of citizen amateurs. The classical statesman Pericles himself danced in a chorus in this theater. And with them in the theatron also stood an image of the god of transformation, theater, and wine, Dionysus, attending the rites over which he had dominion. This vase, pristine, meaning never broken, and in excellent condition, depicts the epiphany of the god. He holds a thyrsus, a rod blooming with vines that have already borne bunches of grapes. As a fertility god, vines bloom literally wherever Dionysus moves. On the left, a comic actor reaches up on tiptoes to pick grapes, while on the right, another stands on a step in order to extend toward the god a large drinking cup. The height indicated by these clues is important, for we are high in the ether. To initiate the festival, a wooden staff with a mask of the god adorned in ivy was carried from his legendary birthplace, Eleutherae, just outside of Athens, into the theater. The passage of the icon of the god through the city took several days and included choral dancing, as well as other kinds of recitations and sacrifices to the god. It culminated in the four-day dramatic competition that was the focal event of the Great Dionysia, the chief cult celebrating the god whose image was the mask. And being so close to Halloween, it's hard for me not to feel like the presence of the god is hovering around us here. Transformation, wine, masks. But he's much more serious than that. All right. On each of 3 days, three tragedians presented their own tetralogy of three tragedies, followed by a satyr play. The fourth day of the festival was given over to the competition of comedies. The city leaders voted the winning productions. Marble steles and monuments were erected in the sanctuary and on the street of Tripods nearby to mark the pride of success. This relief is a large fragment from such a monument, showing with dignified restraint, typical of the classical period, a young actor or chorus man, for all performers at the Great Dionysia were men, holding his tragic female mask by its strap. Though Athens, with her unparalleled literary tradition, was and is the source of Western drama, ancient Greek artists in the colonies of South Italy and Sicily, known as Magna Graecia, were more active in representing the art of ancient Greek theater and celebrated Dionysus just as profoundly in their own festivals. On this monumental crater, decorated by a painter we call the Carnea painter, named after this phase, from Taranto, Italy, which has never been loaned before, is the dominion of the god who watches with his acolytes, two maenads and a satyr, while another maenad reaches an ecstatic moment in her dance. Such large vessels, craters of different kinds, were the centerpiece of the symposium, the cultivated man's drinking party, where they functioned as mixing vessels for the wine. Eventually, these vases take on a funerary association, for they were deposited in tombs and graves and other funerary contexts. The Dionysiac theme of ecstatic transformation gives this painter an opportunity to demonstrate his considerable skill at drawing bodies moving or still, languidly or ecstatically in depth. Note her large eyes, the way she throws her head and the movement of her hair, which is the expected iconography for maenads in ecstatic trances. Greek vase painting is typically a very still art form, but not in this situation. As even our chief curator of paintings mentioned, you can draw differently than this, but you cannot draw any better than this. And so I would encourage you to, when you're visiting the exhibition, to take a very close look, a long look at this phase. Now, to take you back to the origins of ancient Greek drama, some figures that will look very different. I'm saying this so you won't be shocked at the next figures you see. So they're so different from her. Choral performance flourished in Athens long before tragedy as we know it was first presented at the Great Dionysia. A remarkable group of vases dating from about 560 BC to about 480 BC and exhibited together reveals the diversity of performance and its representation in pre-dramatic Athens. This group of fascinating depictions of choruses predating drama is often seen to contain the seeds of the entire dramatic tradition, tragedy, the satyr play, and comedy as it later developed. The proof for a depiction of a choral performance is the aulete, a double pipe player, among the dancers. The earliest is on this cup from Amsterdam, decorated around 560 BC, about the time the Great Dionysia was officially established, with groups of identically costumed masked dancers, some wearing unusual headgear with attached ears or feathers. But the highlight of the group of so-called animal vases that flourished during the middle to the end of the 6th century BC is this Psicter, now in the Metropolitan Museum of Art and dated from 530 to 520. Interpreted as representing the performance of a dithyram, a choral performance of 50 men or boys danced in a circle with the piper in the middle and performed in competition at the Great Dionysia. The dithyram was invented in Corinth by a poet and musician named Arion, whose famous story of kidnapping by pirates and rescue by dolphins is told by Herodotus, who also mentions the dedication of a statue in Arion's honor, inscribed with the very words, Epi Delphinos, upon a dolphin, that the dolphin riders on this vase are singing. Inscribed retrograde, as if issuing from their mouths, The words refer to the ode the Koryuts are singing as they dance. A skillful decorator of drinking cups destined for the symposium, Oltis here composed a choral dance in order to circumnavigate the exterior of a vase in a circular fashion, just as the dance was performed. This is a psichter, a vessel specifically shaped to chill the wine inside of it when submerged in ice-cold water. Carefully designed to be utilized in this way, this vase depicts dolphins that appear to be leaping over the water as they dive around the surface of the vase without interruption. Comparison with a figurine in the Louvre confirms that in practice, chorus men would have costumed themselves by strapping dolphin bodies with fake legs around their waists. From a generation later, around 520 BC, still generations before comedy is established at the Dionysian 486, but during the era when it was performed outside of competition, this large skiphos was decorated with hoplites riding dolphins on one side and young men riding ostriches on the other. Aulites accompany the dancers on both sides of this vase. Shown as six young men armed with spears riding ostriches, this chorus moves towards an aulite. The most interesting figure on this vase is the enigmatic one between the chorus and the aulite, often discussed as the earliest appearance in vase painting of a masked performer dressed exactly like the chorus and interacting directly with it while not performing within it. This little figure provides exceptional evidence for the emergence of the actor. Depending upon whether the chorus is interpreted as proto-comedy or straight choral performance, the masked performer could be identified as a proto-actor, if it's an early comic performance, or as an exarchon, the leader of the dithyrambic song. But painted during the years when the legendary Thespis invented tragedy by placing a mask on his head and delivering a prepared speech back to a chorus, this may be the earliest surviving depiction of an ancient Greek actor. Now, as comfortable as these paintings are with representing choral performance, Athens is reticent to produce paintings of drama, unlike South Italy. The performative context is the same for both, and painters and buyers are also viewers and audience. Athens is comfortable with the world of theater, the actors and their world, just not the plays. For example, the Fiale painter, the Athenian painter, is notable for the remarkable diversity of his iconography, which includes references to the plays of his contemporary Sophocles. On this Pelike, it's a wine storage vase dated to around 440 BC. Two chorus members are depicted in the act of costuming for a performance. Both wear knee-length peploi of the type also worn by maenads. The young man at the right is pulling on his performance boots, called kothornoi. He wears a band around his head in preparation for taking on his mask, which sits on the ground facing him. The youth at the left has finished costuming. He wears a mask identical to the one on the ground, a full female mask with an open mouth and dark hair bound with fillets. His is the active pose of the Koryut, rehearsing the balance of his complex choreography. He holds a woman's mantle over the mask on the ground. The gazes of the two Koryuts equally focus attention toward this mask, called in Greek a prosopon, which translates as both mask and character. The symmetricality and pyramidal composition focusing on the mask communicates that as the actor takes on the mask, he takes on the character. To emphasize this, the Fiale painter has rendered the eye of the mask on the ground inanimate by painting a short stroke of red over it. In contrast, the eye of the mask worn by the dancing Koryut is rendered as naturalistically open and focused. The very same idea is shown in this Apulian crater from Sydney with actors costuming for a satyr play. Having put on his mask, the chorus man on the right is shown to be, I would describe as alive, and transformed into a fertile acolyte of Dionysus, whereas the others are not, and you can see that very easily. So you understand, these paintings are mixtures of some kind of activities the painter has observed, combined with his expression as an artist of the magic of theater.
Another point I would make is that Oltis, who painted those wonderful hoplites riding dolphins, he knew they were actors running around in a circle. But he wanted to show the magic of what they wanted to show, that they were leaping over the sea. So he doesn't paint all the extra things. Now, another view into this multidimensional way to look at this art is the most spectacular theater vase that has survived. A vase made in Athens and found in a local Italic, not Greek, tomb in southern Italy. The so-called Pronomus vase was discovered in a tomb in Ruvo di Puglia in 1835. It owes its name to an inscription accompanying the aulos player seated at the lower register on the front of the vase, who's known by historical inscriptions to have been a famous Theban musician. With many remarkable details of masks, dress, and theater production, this vase offers an extraordinarily rich vision of theatrical practice, providing a complex vision of the Dionysian festival. The viewer is invited into the ritual performance at the end of the festival when the troupe is thanking Dionysus and celebrating its victory, immortalized by the three tripods on the vase. Dionysus himself is present among the actors in order to make visible the presence of the invisible god, and it plays on different levels of reality. There are actual citizens named with their masks in hand, and a dancing one, almost transformed into a real satyr, jumping out of the frame. On the main side of the vase is a theatrical troupe, three actors, a dozen choreutai or chorus men, two musicians, and the poet in the company of none other than the god himself, reclining on a couch next to his bride, Ariadne. Sitting at the end of the couch is an actor who specialized in female roles and who is depicted in female guise by the painter, holding an elaborate female mask with Himeros, desire, the little winged Eros approaching to crown him with a delicate golden wreath. And I would urge you when you are up there to take special look at the fabrics and at the details on this vase, because the harder you will look, the more you will see. This is tragic fabric with very elaborate friezes of quadrigas, sphinxes, horsemen, wave devices, palmettes, and it indicates a textile production of a very, very highly skilled nature, as well as the gown of Ariadne, which is no doubt to be considered woven of golden thread. Next to the right is Heracles, who of all the actors is the only one inscribed, like we needed him inscribed. We really need the other ones inscribed, but Heracles we can tell because there he has with his bow and his arrows, and of course the lion skin, who's always nearby him. This does suggest the play might have concerned one of his adventures, though, because he was extremely popular. And he's standing with Papa Silenus, the father of the satyrs and the leader of the satyr chorus. Although these actors and chorus men have completed an entire tetralogy, that is, they have spent all day performing in four plays, each of which is at least 90 minutes long, okay? That makes at least 8 hours altogether. The painter's not interested in representing the play as much as he is in depicting the cast with Dionysus. All except for one, they hold their masks in their hands and seem to be waiting or relaxing. The only active choreute is the satyr, dancing next to the aulos player, Pronomus. The satyr wears his mask and dances. His foot overlaps the ornamental band on the ground line as if he were jumping out of the picture. The very vivid effect provides a sharp contrast between this dancer and the other choreutai, who were evidently out of costume. Under one handle, a young choreute is holding his mask behind his back. The mask is turned toward the other side of the vase, looking at the satyrs dancing in the sacred komos. Their features of the real satyrs are identical to the mask worn by the satyr chorus. And on the other side of the vase, the young god is walking in the dance among four satyrs and three maenads, as well as a little flying eros. Two levels of representation, then, the mythical and the mortal, are thus connected. The mythic theosos of Dionysus, the satyrs and maenads on the back of the vase, and the god's mortal acolytes, the actors, playwright, and musicians, on the main side of the vase. This spectacular work provides a convenient bridge for presenting the artistic relationship and differences between Athens and Magna Graecia, where Athenian theater was extraordinarily popular and imported from Athens in high numbers. Aeschylus visited Sicily at least twice. He directed a reperformance of his Persians there in Syracuse in 470 BC, and on another trip, fated to be his last, he died and was buried in Gela in 456 BC. There are also legendary stories of the Sicilians' great love for the plays of Euripides. Yet though the colonies and Italic settlements maintained close ties to the Athenian homeland, the regions had very different artistic traditions concerning the representation of performance. When confronted with depicting the public staging of dramatic poetry, and here I show you a majestic crater in the collection at the Cleveland Museum of Art showing the escape of Medea at the end of the play by Euripides. It's an astonishing flight of her chariot, which might have been accomplished by means of a crane-like device called a mechane. The painters of ancient Greek vases approached their task according to a complex set of visual paradigms rooted in the traditional ways in which epic and mythic narratives had been depicted for generations. Although artisans and playwrights both relied on knowledge of myth and legend to achieve their narrative aims, the vase painters were extremely limited in comparison to the poets, who were actively engaged with the production of the play and could utilize the many tools of performance, choreography, sets, properties, masks, costumes, and music to realize their vision. For the vase painters, the overwhelming sensory experience of viewing a tetralogy in a theatron with thousands in attendance had to be expressed as a single scene on the curved surface of a vase destined for the relatively intimate use of the symposion. To provide clarity, the artisans relied on practical approaches, such as choosing a vase shape like this one to accommodate their compositions and employing recognizable iconographic tools. While knowledge of the play, in this case the scene of Medea escaping from the murder of her children in her dragon chariot, is essential for comprehending the iconography fully, an awareness of the many ways in which performance must have inspired and influenced these depictions plays a critical role in our understanding. In this particular case, while the scene is obviously that of Medea's escape, we see that because she has left the children behind, we are either looking at a different version of the play, in other words, not Euripides' version, in which she takes the children with her, or an invention of the artist. Take one of the most famous tragedies from ancient Athens, the Oresteia by Aeschylus. There are no depictions from the first play, the Agamemnon, but the second play of the trilogy, the Coophory, the Libation Bearers, provides the audience with a focus on Electra, her reunion with her brother Orestes, and the murder of their mother, Clytemnestra. This play opens with Electra mourning at the grave of Agamemnon. An urn is brought to her with the ashes of her brother. As she laments, grief-stricken at her inability to set things right, Orestes and Pylades approach. In a unique example from Pestum, south of Naples, the only example of this scene that survives, of the prelude to the killing of Clytemnestra, Orestes has aggressively grabbed her by the hair. Notice his hat has dropped off onto his shoulders and prepares to kill her. In a heart-wrenching scene from the play, Clytemnestra says to her son, "Take pity on this breast." In other words, "I gave you life." And if you saw Electra at the villa, you will know that Sophocles treats this play very differently. Yet the story of Electra and Orestes was compelling to all three of the major tragedians, for Euripides and Sophocles wrote their plays virtually at the same time. A fury advances from above, symbolizing the blood guilt Orestes will incur with the crime of matricide. The Furies are not in this play, but the painter has taken liberty to enforce the horror of the scene and what will come by bringing in the avenging spirit to point her snakes at both Orestes and Clytemnestra. Features unique to certain plays can be key to developing an understanding of the iconography. In the Eumenides, Aeschylus has the priestess of Apollo come upon the slouching, stinking Furies. With charred skin, their eyes dripped a foul ooze. Pythia wonders what she has seen that they could resemble. She recalls a wall painting of harpies and thinks also of the monstrous Gorgons. The horrid appearance of the Erinyes and their pursuit of Orestes can serve to identify the Oresteia in vase painting, even though they appear in the Eumenides only as evil demons who pursue Orestes to Delphi after he kills Clytemnestra. In art, they appear in reunion scenes as well. And here in this particular painting, they appear together with Orestes at the Omphalos in Delphi. Above him, Apollo is holding a sacrificed piglet because it is part of the purification of Apollo to drip the piglet's blood upon Orestes. This is in an early part of the play, but it's mentioned. It's not a scene from the play. So there are many different kinds of informations that the artist includes here. And in this detail, a very poignant detail, from this spectacular crater, the ghost of Clytemnestra tries to wake the sleeping Furies, but they've now become the Eumenides, the kindly ones, presaging their transformation at the trial of Orestes in Athens. Only one painter shows a tragedy on stage. He is a Sicilian painter, active around 330 BC, and we call him the Capodarso painter. The action takes place in a space that represents a stage set, with the main character standing on a raised platform between four columns. On the left, an elderly white-haired man, clad in traveling clothes and boots, leans on a staff and gestures with his left hand toward a tall, richly clad couple in the center of the composition. Both look toward him, focused on what he is saying. The painter emphasized the psychological power of the scene by turning the figure of this old man toward the viewer, the audience, as if he is speaking directly to them. Note his hand is framed by the column that holds up the stage set. He does not wear a mask, but his anguished expression communicates an event of great magnitude. The man to his left, on whose face is clearly depicted an expression of dramatic confusion, stands between two female figures rendered on a smaller scale. The woman standing next to him also turns toward the old man and raises her veil to her face with both hands. A final figure faces away from the others, concluding the action with a similar gesture of anguish. This unusually powerful composition very probably depicts the scene in Sophocles' Oedipus Tyrannus, in which the old Corinthian relates to Oedipus the death of his foster father, King Polybus. As the conversation unfolds, Oedipus and Iocasta discover his true birth. The vase shows the dramatic instant in which Iocasta, understanding the significance of this revelation before her husband does, realizes the secret of her real relationship to Oedipus. She will leave the stage in a state of anguish to put an end to her own life. In contrast to typical representations of tragedy, which avoid realistic depiction of stage architecture, costumes, or masks, this Sicilian vase painter represents the mythical characters of the play as if they themselves were on the stage. And he uses heightened expressions specifically to reference masked performance. Now, you can imagine that after watching three plays of such tragic intensity, something different would be called for. And it was said that a more Dionysiac kind of performance had become necessary to finish the tetralogy with a focus on the god being honored. The satyr play subverts the serious, epic, and mythic themes of drama by inserting satyrs into well-known narratives from myth and epic. It's a particular kind of dramatic form. And on display in a small gallery upstairs is a very valuable frame from the second most completely preserved satyr play papyrus, Sophocles Ichneutai, or Trackers. Here, the satyrs act as searchers for the stolen cattle of Apollo, tracking them down to a hidden cave where they find Hermes inventing the lyre. The sound terrifies them, as they've never heard the music of strings, and they wonder what kind of animal with strings attached to its body could make a sound such as this. And for the English translation, you can either ask Professor Michael Hackett, who's with us today, or you can go up to the gallery, which is what I really want you to do, and listen to the wonderful piece that was developed by our Collections and Information and Access Department on this papyrus. As Carol mentioned, Professor Hackett is going to be leading a group of students also here with us today. In a performance, a workshop performance, I want to make sure this is clear, of some amazing pieces they've put together on the Seder play, and that will be on November 19th and repeated on November 20th. So we're very excited about that. Now, virtually all of these plays are lost. We have one complete play, the Cyclops by Euripides. There is a vase in the exhibition that shows that play. And the second most preserved is Sophocles' Trackers. And after that, it's very, very scanty. There are many references, but very little text. This particular vase is a very famous depiction of a satyr chorus that we don't have. And it's very well known, but it has never been exhibited, and it was covered in old overpaint. It was conserved by Jeff Mache in our conservation department here at the Villa, who removed the old work in order that the scene can now be read more clearly. On the shoulder, five members of a satyr chorus dance toward two musicians. The chorus men wear identical full head masks of satyrs with large ears, perizoma, those are the shorts, with attached phalluses and long, bushy horse tails. For satyrs are hybrids of horses and humans. Not pans, but horses and humans. Through depiction of specifically choreographed poses of stepping, bending, crouching, and kicking, the vase painter intended to represent the vivid appearance of a satyr dance. As they dance, they each carry a leg belonging to a single piece of elaborate furniture, probably the legs and crossbars of a symposium couch or throne for Dionysus. The satyr on the far right sets his leg down in front of a piper, whose elaborate robes billow as he taps his foot to the music. Now, although the satyr play must have and still does elicit laughter, it was not comedy. Its form kept within the closed world of tragic drama, whereas the comic plot and actor engaged with the audience and inspired vase paintings that actually show scenes on stage. This is the most elaborate representation of a stage set to have survived, and it comes from a private collection in Rome. Two comic actors wear costumes called flyax costumes, which consist of short padded tunics that expose large attached genitalia, saggy leggings, and outsized, grotesquely comic masks, play the pipes in a sanctuary. They perform on a wooden stage, reached by steps and supported by elaborate columns. The area underneath the stage, no doubt a repository for costumes and scenery, is hidden by a curtain decorated with local South Italian geometric designs. Their pipes, incongruously stuck into the mouths of their masks, these pipers would be unable to make a sound. The real music is being made by a piper hidden behind the tree, who correctly wears his pipe. This meta-theatricality, typical of comic depictions, is wittily engaging and just as complex to entangle as the iconography of the tragic faces, in some ways more so, because in some cases, as here, it only appears to be so real. As I said, we have none of these plays, so we cannot tell any further plot for this. But it is clear that successful comic themes typically relied on parodies of the gods. This wonderful vase from the Vatican collection and once in the collection of the painter Anton Raphael Mengs, so it has a provenance that goes back, I suppose, at least 300 years, is also evidence of the only painter we know of, perhaps, Astyus, to have depicted both tragic and comic scenes. He also depicted in this exhibition the madness of Heracles from Madrid. This scene of Zeus and Hermes out on the town is a classic example of old comedy, parody, and foolishness. Hermes on the right wearing his traveler's cap over his bald pate has got his Kerikeion upside down. And he's holding his lamp up in such a way that all of the lamp oil would drain out of it and he would lose his fire very quickly. And there's Zeus with him, who has his head stuck in the ladder, and he's wearing this very silly-looking crown. They're out looking for Alcmene. There she is, gazing down at them in the manner of a common prostitute with her little fingertips over the windowsill. But the most valuable comic vase from ancient Greece, maybe this one. This is known as the Punishment of the Thief. It's in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. It dates to about 400 BC, so it's a very early one. It's traditionally attributed to the Tarporli painter, who also painted those wonderful satyr actors, costuming for a satyr play that I showed you earlier. It's very important for scholarship because it's painted by an Apulian vase painter. That is a South Italian vase painter, but it includes Athenian inscriptions that are painted as if issuing from the mouths of the actors. And for this reason, the vase has been accepted as depicting a comedy that originated in Athens and has been imported to South Italy, where the vase was painted. These two vases, here are some of these. So you have this man in the middle, who is looking towards an old man with his hands up in the air, and the letters falling down and out of the old man's mouth say, "He's bound my hands up above me." Whereas the man in the middle, those letters going right across the middle of the screen, are ancient Greek letters, but they don't form words. They say nothing. They're nonsense. And so it is thought that this particular character is a foreign character. And indeed, we know that the Athenians hired Scythians as their police force from time to time. And so they wouldn't have spoken particularly great Athenian dialect. The words across the top, which you can probably sort of read, even if you don't read Greek, tragoidos, it says the tragedian. So what's this doing in a comic vase? You can think about that. Then here is a detail from the other vase I'm about to show you of exactly the same character as the Tarporli painter's vase. If you look at the two masks, you can see that they're both curly-headed, dark hair, young man, and he has a large lower jaw and a very large lower lip jutting out. This is the same mask and could very well be the mask of a foreigner. It's not the mask of an Athenian. Now, you may be noting the very strange costume that he wears, which is called a stage naked costume. And this is a joke off of the beautiful torsos of the athletic young Athenians that we see in, for example, the Agrigento Youth, which we just installed, right? So how aristocratic young men gain their civic idealistic nobility is by exercising so they have perfectly toned bodies. And how you make fun of them is showing them like this. By strapping onto yourself a saggy kind of a costume with long arms and legs and has a big bulbous stomach with attached long genitalia and breasts. So this is what a heroic kind of a nude looks like in comedy. So it's all about making fun of the other guy, really, is what it's all about. But here are the two vases together. And they are exhibited together for the first time. And when we had the symposium here several weeks ago, all of the scholars were very, very excited to be able to look at the actual vases, one in storage in Boston typically, one on view in New York typically. We were able to look at them together, look back and forth, and really notice that, yes, the old man, this is probably the same old man. And what's going on with the game, and what is this old woman saying? Well, the old woman up on the dais is saying, we shall hand him over, or I shall hand him over to you. And she's got up on the stage with her a dead goose, as you can see. And behind with the goose is a basket with two live kids in it, or small game like a lamb or a small goat. Then on the right, you have behind the old man on this stage, you have a live goose. And you've got a double yolk basket again with small young animals in it. But in between the scene on the right and the scene on the left, something happened and this goose got killed and the old woman is really angry about it. So therein lies the comedy. And the other interesting aspect of this also is that the vase painting on the right was done maybe 20 years after the one on the left. So we know that these comedies were popular. We know that they were repeated. And then we know that they were represented by artists time after time. And so we come full circle from the genesis of drama in Athenian choral dance to the continued pervasive influence of Athenian comedy on productions in South Italy 200 years later. To understand that, in order to comprehend ancient Greek theater, you have to comprehend the art of ancient Greek theater. Thank you.